Because we had, my boycott experience was mostly in Canada, and we had church support on the second boycott. Well, we had church support during both boycotts, but it was especially strong during the second boycott, both institutionally as well as from lay people and, I don't know how to distinguish it, clergy, in other words, the parish priests and the sisters and the members of the orders.
Right. Now, when you say the first boycott and the second boycott, what are you talking about?
The first boycott being the first great boycott, 68 to 70, and the second boycott being the second great boycott, 73 to 75.
Okay.
During the first great boycott, what we had was more sisters, priests, local pastors than we did institutional.
Where were you in Canada?
The first boycott I was in Toronto. Well, it was in Toronto and I was in Montreal. Probably, I ended up being about 1 year in Toronto and a year and a half in Montreal during the first boycott. And then the second boycott, I was primarily in Toronto, although I did a lot of traveling throughout Canada. To speak at conventions and things.
Why were you sent to Canada?
Because Toronto is the third largest grape market in North America for California grapes. And Montreal is the fifth largest. I'm saying is. They were at that point. I'm not sure what they are now. But Toronto third, Montreal fifth. And so that's why we went up there. Although I haven't the slightest idea where that was
when I went up there.
Oh, really?
No, no. We got, back in 68, we got, of course we volunteered to go on the boycott, but then we got asked to go different places, and I got asked if I would go to Toronto, and I said, sure, because I didn't know where it was. I hadn't the slightest idea where it was. I don't think I realized it was in another country, for one thing, and I'm sure I didn't realize that it was about 3,500 miles, 3,000 miles, 3,500 miles.
It's a long way from home.
Very long way from home.
How old were you then?
I was 21 when I went the first time. In the first boycott, three of us went. Father Mark Day, Marshall Gans, and myself. The second boycott, about 27 of us went. It was Marshall and myself returned, and then a very large group of farm workers, strikers from Fresno, Delano, Bakersfield. Good group of people. So they were very different in terms of our approaches. Well, not so much in terms of our approaches, but in terms of, it's different to have two people arrive or three people arrive in Toronto looking for some place to stay and food to eat and all that, and arrive with 27 or 28 people. But what we found was that because of all the friends that we had made, that the boycott had made during that first time around, when we got there on the second boycott, there were about 120, 130 people waiting for us in the hall with food and, you know, a welcoming committee. And it was labor and church and people from the political party up there, which is called the New Democratic Party. Well, there's three parties, but the one that was most supportive was the New Democratic Party. And then people who had become involved in the boycott who hadn't belonged to anything in particular, but who became active in the boycott.
Who organized that big welcome party?
The old boycott support committee. The volunteers. We had a really good
committee.
Very good group of volunteers. The friendships last to this day. You know, we don't, it's very far, so we don't stay in touch regularly, but when we talk, it's as if we had just seen each other. And I haven't been there in 10 years, almost 11 years.
So you still have some contact with
those
people?
Yeah. And they became family for me because I spent so much time with them. A number of those folks became actual, like, family, like brothers, sisters. Uncle Vance, you know?
Yeah. In terms of, oh gosh, there's so much, I mean, there's so many things that went on. I'm trying to think of what particular things it would be good to focus on in terms of some of the experiences. Maybe if I go backwards, that might help. You know, if I start sort of with the second boy, kind of go back. Well, first of all, if it hadn't been for church support during that second boycott, I really don't know what we would have done, in spite of having very good supporters. Mm-hmm. Because we were a large group, and we had...
Where did you live?
Well, that was, I mean, our first problem. First of all, we were a large group. Secondly, we were coming out of a strike situation, which meant that we were as limited in our resources as ever, mm-hmm. probably even more so. Mm-hmm. And so... I can't remember who made the contact, but someone had called Father Bob Madden at St. Basil's Seminary in Toronto and asked him, see if I could get the seminaries right here. Yeah, it started up there. And had asked him if the men, at least, in our group could stay on an emergency basis with them until we got ourselves settled. And he said yes. I had not met him before. I don't remember having met him before. Father Bob Madden, M-A-D-D-E-N. I think he went from Toronto to Vancouver for a while, and I think he's back in Toronto.
And teaching. I take it that he's a Catholic priest.
Catholic priest. And I think he's teaching now at St. Michael's College in Toronto, at the university. But we didn't really know him before. And he opened the doors of St. Basil's Seminary to the men in our group. And they lived there from then until we got people to come back to California. Some people lived there for over 2 years at the seminary. And they were never, they because the men were the ones that were living there actually. Never made to feel unwelcome, never made to feel like they were imposing in any way. I mean, they had rooms that they were living in, they ate, they had all their meals. All of us had our meals there for the first 5 or 6 months. We had our dinner there for sure, and if we were in the area for lunch and for breakfast, we could do that too. But on a regular basis, we ate dinner there. And in fact, because, I mean, when you're talking 27 additional people, it affected their budget, and they had to make a decision about choosing between whether they would continue to feed us or whether they would cut back on the kinds of meals that they ate, because they ate very nicely. Mm-hmm. And they had a meeting of their community and decided to cut back, and to, you know, cut back on certain food items so that we could continue to eat there. I'll never forget, on the 12th of December, it was very hard because a lot of the folks that went with us were about the age I was when I first went out. They were 19, 20, 21, very committed, very dedicated, but very lonely and very missing their family. A lot of them had never been away from their families. And so it was emotionally a hard time. And I'll never forget, Father Madden, they invited us to come to dinner as usual. So we went. On the 12th of December, they did this beautiful Mexican dinner. They had, a couple of seminarians had driven to Detroit to buy tortillas and to buy, you know, Mexican food. They didn't know how to cook Mexican food, but they got cookbooks out and the cooks, you know, they just figured out because they wanted it. It was a surprise. It was so beautiful. It was just... we walked in, and the tables were decorated, and it was like a very special program that they did for us.
So is the 12th of December a special holiday?
It is. It's the Catholic Church. It's the day of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Oh, of course.
It's the day of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So it was like especially significant.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and it was great. It was great, and then they. They would. The seminary holds a very special place, as does Father Madden for all of us that were on that boycott. Father Madden, in fact, started picketing with us. He started vigiling with us. He did go to meetings with us. So he became very involved, not only in providing shelter and food and a home, but in becoming an active part of the boycott. And a very respected person. And became so close to all of us that we really don't call him Father Matt, we call him Uncle Bob, because that's how close we all got to him. Mm-hmm. He would do receptions sometimes. You know, he'd do special receptions at certain holiday times. One of the families had two children that were, gosh, they're in college now, but they would have been, I think, about 7 and 8 years old at that point. And they had not made their Holy Communion yet. And so they studied and they asked Father Madden if he would do the ceremony. And so he did a special mass and all the seminarians were there. And then there was a special little celebration for them in the cafeteria. So it was also instant organization, because whenever there were vigils and picket lines, the farm worker strikers that were living there would drag the seminarians out with them, you know, to have a picket line or to do a vigil or to do whatever.
You mentioned vigils. Did you make use of vigils quite a lot?
We did vigils primarily, both on the second boycott and on the first boycott. We did vigils the week before Christmas. Mm-hmm. There would be a different chain store each mm-hmm. year that we would be focusing on. And we would do an 8-day, 24-hour day vigil in front of one of their stores, which was cold, very cold.
Like how cold?
Oh, it'd be 15 degrees, 20 degrees. At night it would drop even more. The people were great. They'd bring... And there are 24-hour day stores there, mm-hmm. so it was more symbolic than anything. Mm-hmm. But the people would bring us chocolate and, you know, hot chocolate or coffee or sandwiches or different things. And we'd take turns. And it wasn't just us doing it. It would be people from the community would sign up to do it with us. So there were always California farm worker people and local boycott supporters. Mm-hmm. Who were vigiling together. We were never only one mm-hmm. part. But they were very beautiful, and we'd end them with masses. Mm-hmm. Actually, the first 2 years that we were up there, we did the vigils, Marshall fasted mm-hmm. for the 8 days.
For the 8 days.
Mm-hmm. And he was out there. And he's not a churchman, but beautiful story. 1969. Our campaign was against a store called Loblaws, chain store.
How do you spell that?
L-O-B-L-A-W.
L-O-B-L-A-W?
Uh-huh, apostrophe, yes. Okay. And they were being very stubborn. They didn't want to cooperate. And it was very cold winter. And Marshall decided he was going to fast. And there was going to be this 8-day vigil. And so people were very supportive. Now remember, there were only the two of us around at that point. And maybe we had already gotten some people from Canada to come on staff with us and work with us. Because we recruited a lot of Canadians into the staff of the union. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the vigil, Christmas Eve, we went over to the office, to the boycott office, to celebrate Christmas Eve and to... watch Marshall break his fast, basically. Someone had made him, I think, mushroom soup or something so he could break his fast. And so we were going through that ceremony, through that celebration, and the director, the Ontario director of the Public Employees Union, came over and he said, "Gee, do you think I could have a bit of that soup?" And so, of course, Keeley, his name is Keeley Cummings, very dignified, white-haired gentleman. And so he started sipping on the soup. Well, it came out that Keeley had been fasting the whole time, too, in solidarity with Marshall. Well, with the union, of course, and with the whole struggle. But he had been doing it without having declared it or anything. And oh, it was very rewarding to see that, you know, very, because he was very special. He was a very good supporter of the boycott. He'd go on delegations and picket lines and do everything, and for him to do that was very special.
How do you spell his name?
Keeley is K-E-E-L, jeez, I think L-Y. I don't think there's another E in there. And then Cummings, C-U-M-M-I-N-G. You know, the boycott is, the only thing that made the boycott work, well, I shouldn't say the only thing, but the thing that made the boycott work was the way in which people from the communities that we were in, from the cities that we were in, the way in which they got involved. If people had said, yes, I'll support you by not buying grapes, and if that had been the end of it, we never would have won. All the people that didn't buy grapes were very important to the winning of the boycott, but there was a lot more to it than that. A lot more to the involvement. And we had people who we met through speaking at a union meeting or speaking at a church or being handing out leaflets and talking to people in front of stores. We had people who came to help, because we're always asking for people to help, who came to help maybe one day a week or a couple hours a week, and before you knew it, they all held full-time jobs and stuff. They were coming in every night after work. They were coming in all weekend, and they were becoming part of the boycott family. Mm-hmm. They had as much commitment as we did, if not more. Mm-hmm. Because we were from California, they weren't, mm-hmm. and they were from another country. They were just totally the last people you'd expect to see getting involved, but they did get involved. Mm-hmm. I think the reason they got involved is not only because the cause was just, but because in fact there was a way for them to participate. Because it was a positive way to bring about change, a positive, happy, joyful way to work towards finding some justice. I think we all like that. And it's no fun to, even though the situation in California was bad in terms of strikes, in terms of the suffering of farm workers, in terms of the conditions, in terms of all of that, you had to present that situation because those were the realities, but you had to do the work of the boycott in a positive and joyful way. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people would have said, "Oh, gee, I'm really sorry to hear that," and then not gotten involved. You know, not wanted. I mean, who wants to be around a little cloud, right? But we did. We worked very hard. All the volunteers worked very hard, and we leaflet and we'd pick it and we'd stay up till all hours writing letters or newsletters or going to meetings or all the things that are involved in doing the boycott. But we'd always have times that we would be together in a social context. We'd have our meetings on Saturdays at the end of the day, or we'd have our potlucks once a month for all of us. Mm-hmm. All the volunteers would all get together and have potlucks and have singing and have a program. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of speeches, more singing and sharing reports, people talking about what they had done at their store or what kind of response they had gotten at their store. The emphasis was always on the positive. Mm-hmm. We'd learn from if there was, frankly, in Canada there was very little hostility, mm-hmm. except from some of the chain stores, of course.
From management,
mm-hmm. and then when we were involved in a fight with the Teamsters, well, then we had some problems related to that, too, as did everyone. Mm-hmm. But from the general public and from the organizations and from the churches, and we had no hostility. Mm-hmm. We had to nudge people mm-hmm. to get them, as, you know, in organizations we'd have to nudge and push and pull and holler and do all that to get people to become actively involved. But people never said, go away, mm-hmm. You don't belong here, we don't want to help you, we don't have room for you.
The farm workers that went on the second boycott, the strikers, were some of them monolingual in Spanish?
Absolutely. We had probably about half were Spanish-speaking only. Mm-hmm. Of the ones that spoke English, a number of them, even though they had grown up in the United States, and they were American citizens, they'd been born and raised here, hadn't really been to school, mm-hmm. And so they couldn't read or write. They had difficulty with the language.
So that they could speak English, but they would have problems if they were presented with a map to find such and such in some big city.
And absolutely. And we had, you had the combination of the language, the language, the not only the speaking of it, but the reading and the writing of it, but also just the culture shock of going from the Central Valley of California to Toronto with its subways and it's a big city, very nice one, but a big city. We had and then additionally for some of the people in the group who were young women, there was not only the culture shock of going from one city, from one town to a big city, but also being on their own being on their own, having to be independent.
It's probably the first time that any of the young women had ever been on their own, I would assume.
In our situation, the women that were with us that were single, it was.
Because that's not part of the culture.
It's not part of the culture at all. No. And in fact, when I left on the first boycott, that was my situation. Although I could read and write and speak English and all that, but it was the same culture problem, because I'd never been away from my home, really.
How did their families feel about that, or how did your family feel about it?
I think their families felt probably the same way that my family felt about it. My parents, because I'm the oldest, were very proud that I was working with the union, extremely proud. A lot of respect for the union and for the struggle. But at the same time, I think felt torn about their child being so far away from them, where they didn't know what was happening. And I think the parents of these young women that went with us on the second boycott felt, they had the same mixed feelings about it. We had one young woman who then became one of the best organizers we had in Canada, in Toronto, on that second boycott, who would literally cry before leaving the office to go get on the subway to go somewhere because she was so scared. And she would sit in the office in tears, saying, I don't want to go and I'm scared and I'm going to get lost. And, you know, and so we talked and talked and talked until we got her convinced that she wouldn't get lost, that this was what you had to do and this is where you had to go. And it was very hard on her and on all of us in the beginning. But once she got over that fear, she really took off. And then you couldn't stop her. You couldn't keep her off the subway, you know. She was great. She was great. And she was able to organize all kinds of groups. And she could organize churches as easily as she could organize labor, as easily as she could organize community groups or political groups. She was excellent.
I remember interviewing Maria Sayudado.
Yes.
In early March. And her stories about going out on the boycott, it was the same kind of story. It was real. I mean, I don't know that she was in tears, but I remember her talking about going to New York City.
Oh, my gosh.
With Eliseo.
Yes.
And she said she got lost a lot of times in the same building.
Right.
But yeah. It was... an amazing thing that all those young people and all those young women did that.
Probably the biggest thing that all of us, or a lot of us who hadn't been out before, learned. Probably really all of us, whether we'd been from a little town or a big city. I think one of the biggest things that we learned was to ask for things. Not so much for ourselves, or actually rarely for ourselves, but to learn to ask. If we needed help for the boycott, well then to learn to ask for that help and not be ashamed or afraid to do that. If we needed people to come and picket, to do it, to ask, to not say no for people. That's one of Fred Ross's big rules, right, is don't say no for people. Don't say, oh no, they wouldn't want to do that because da 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 da. Ask them, and then if they say no, okay, it's not the end of the world. You try and figure out how you get them to change the no to a yes, but don't ever say no for people. Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid to ask. And I know it was real hard for me to ask at first, and I know it was real hard for people, for a lot of people who went out on the boycott to ask for anything when we first went out. It almost seemed like it went against pride to have to ask. Mm-hmm. But then what we found out was that people are just waiting to be asked. Yeah, that it's good that we did it. Mm-hmm. And certainly that's, like I say, what we found with a lot of the volunteers out on the boycott was that it was people with good with good ideas, with good feelings, with good inclinations about justice and about other human beings, but who'd never been given an opportunity to do anything about it or to express it in any way. And the boycott gave them that opportunity. And so those people gave us a lot. They gave the union a lot, they gave the boycott a lot, they made the struggle, the victory of the struggle possible. And they also received a lot, so it was worth. We gave each other, and I think that what happened with a lot of the people that we touched, who were volunteers who never came on staff, that a lot of the good things that they learned from the boycott, they turned around and applied it in their own communities, not necessarily related to farm workers at all, but applied it in issues that have come up in their own community. I know that in Canada, there was no awareness of the fact that there were farm workers in Canada. And after the boycott, or during the boycott, or I guess it was like right between the two boycotts, there started to be the realization that right down in the Niagara Peninsula, just south of Toronto, there were a lot of farm workers who were living in conditions not unlike those that California farm workers were living in, and working for the same kinds of wages. So it raised that issue. It made people aware of that issue. And people didn't say, oh, well, gee, we have our own farm workers that we have to worry about now. They said, you know, if it hadn't been for the boycott, we wouldn't have been aware of this, and now we have to do something about this, too. Mm-hmm. So it woke that up. I think it probably did that in some other states as well, in the United States. Or other parts of the country in the United States. Certainly, I know that it had impact on the struggle and the boycotts had impact on the Chicano movement in California. I mean, that's why there was a Chicano movement, I believe, because of the union. So it had all kinds of ripple effects. And you see with staff, with people who have gone through the union as full-time staff at different points, if it was a little while or a long while, doesn't matter. The discipline particularly that was learned in the union, you see people applying that to whatever kind of work they're doing. Mm-hmm. Now, it tends to be work with people, with and for people. So I lost my thread, but I'm trying to remember some of the particular church people we had. We had on the second boycott, our church support was very special. We had both the institutional support, the Archbishop, in Toronto, the United Church of Canada, the Anglicans, Canadian Council of Churches. I think those were the main ones. Mm-hmm. At their top levels, they were supporting the boycott, and the way we structured it was that we had a committee of either the top leadership from the churches or people representing them, or an individual representing. For example, in the case of the Archbishop, it was Father Brad Massman who represented him. He was like his right-hand person. As well, we had
them on what?
Or on a committee. It was like a...
like an interfaith committee or something of that type?
It was... I like to use a different word. What's coming to mind, it was like the heavies, you know? It was the heavies committee. We had a formal name for it, which is what I'm trying to... Because we had our clergy action committee, which was different. But our clergy...